Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast. In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Sean Carbonell, president of the 501c3 nonprofit Cure Glioblastoma and former CEO of the biotech startup OncoSynergy. We discussed why he dropped out of neurosurgery residency, the challenges he faced navigating the startup scene, and the best avenue to make meaningful, lasting change in medicine. Today's show is perfect for anyone thinking about healthcare startups and nonprofits, or just intrigued by the idea of making an impact. So, without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Carbonell. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So, we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
The proverbial med student interview question. So I grew up being in love with biology and life. I was fascinated by bugs, and I had virtually every type of pet you could have. I dragged my father to the library. So I grew up in the 80s. We did not have internet. We did not have Google. We had encyclopedias and libraries, and dragged my father to libraries every weekend. And I would devour every book on biology that I could find, and even made him take me to all the libraries in our district in order to be complete. And so I always had that sort of bias. And, you know, growing up, obviously, I thought about what types of careers that could be. And in fifth grade, I drew myself as a scientist. But as I was entering college, I still wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. But by default, you know, to be frank, I'm Asian. My parents highly encouraged me to become a physician. And so I entered the University of Washington as an undergrad, as a pre-med, not really knowing if that's what I truly wanted to do. And meanwhile, the first year of college is a rough transition. And I had a hard time, and because I wasn't really enjoying the schoolwork I was doing. And a lot of it was non-biological, of course. And it wasn't until my sophomore year that I really sort of realized it was my calling. And that was an incident I had over the summer. And I actually had to perform CPR on a 14-year-old boy. And, you know, it's a long story, but that's the ultimate thing that happened. My friends and I were chaperoning a party for some younger siblings of a friend of mine. And it was going fine until the end. And the boy stopped breathing, and I couldn't find a pulse. And so my friend Jen and I started CPR, and the whole thing, called 911, ambulance came. And then we woke up, we went to the ER and waited for news. And thankfully, he did okay. And that really was the switch that sort of, you know, I was pretty half-hearted at the beginning, because again, I was not sure I wanted to be pre-med. But that was a point where I really dug in and decided, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to half-ass it.
It's really great to hear your trajectory to becoming interested in medicine. Now, currently, you're on social media and you boast an impressive following. You're known as Brain Surgery Dropout. And in fact, you dropped out of your neurosurgery residency program at Cedars-Sinai to fight glioblastoma full-time. For our listeners at home, glioblastoma multiforme is the most common primary brain cancer and one of the most aggressive cancers out there, period. So I want to ask you, what factors led up to this monumental decision to drop out of residency?
Another huge question. It was a lot of factors, obviously, that built up to that. You know, after I became a non-half-hearted pre-med and really dug in, you know, I had some really formative research experiences with neurosurgeons, and was, you know, very fortunate to find a very kind mentor, Sean Grady, who was the chair at UPenn until this year. Recently, he just retired, but he really took me under his wing, and I published three first author papers with him as an undergraduate, and that sort of set the trajectory for me becoming an academic neurosurgeon now. So, you know, that was 19 when this all started. Flash forward a decade, and after graduating with my MD PhD, after putting off my residency initially to study further, to basically double down on my brain cancer research at Oxford University in England, I made a discovery in England, basically, was what happened. And it was something that I felt was a massive opportunity for patients, and also potentially commercially, because no one was interested in that particular target. But I went ahead and applied for neurosurgery because I wasn't sure what I would do with this information. They had actually offered me a faculty position at Oxford, which I was strongly considering, but ultimately I wasn't ready to give up the clinical work as a neurosurgeon. And so I went through the match in 2008, 2009. And as you mentioned, very fortunate to match at Cedars-Sinai. I'm very drawn to that program because the chair, of course, who is still the current chair, Dr. Black, is a renowned glioblastoma neurosurgeon. And he also promised me a lab and a faculty position as an intern. You know, and I actually got more than one offer like that, which is incredibly humbling. So it was a huge opportunity, and I could have done residency and developed this idea, but at least that's what I thought. right. So the realities of intern year as a neurosurgery intern made me think in other directions, right? I'd be in the call room at 4 a.m. thinking about this idea, what this massive opportunity, and no one is going after it. And I eventually got to the point where, you know, if I don't do this, then no one is probably going to do this. And so I basically saw an opportunity to have a bigger impact on glioblastoma patients. You know, as a neurosurgeon, I'd have a one-to-one impact, which is important, and we need that. But at the same time, glioblastoma is something where there's only 5 approved therapies in the past 20 years, and none of them meaningfully extend survival. And so I saw this as an opportunity to bring, you know, possibly a 6th. And so that's basically how I arrived at the decision. This is probably the hardest decision of my life.
Yeah, for sure. And the question that I really want to get at is, what would you tell someone who similarly wants to leave clinical medicine for the biotech startup scene, but is worried about the risks?
Yeah, so it really comes down to knowing yourself, right? It's self-awareness. It's, you know, it sounds glamorous. And of course, if you've watched the movies like The Social Network, the story about Facebook, it's very glamorous, and it's exciting how, you know, just out of a dorm room, he was able to build this multi-billion dollar company. And I too got caught up in that, to be frank, but it's not for everyone, right? And it's definitely a huge risk to take. And there's not very good preparation in medical school for this type of career, because when you decide to become a physician, your career trajectory and what you do on the day-to-day is pretty much set for the next 10 to 15 years and maybe even 20 years. You don't even have to think about that. You can just focus on your studies. If you want to get into a startup and entrepreneurship, none of that is guaranteed. There is no trajectory. It could be a Facebook thing and you can raise $500,000 from Peter Thiel in 1 or 2 months. Or like my first startup, OncoSynergy, you can slog for several years before you even get any traction, and it's really difficult. And so there is uncertainty built into that, which is, I think, for the majority of people who are interested in medicine and in research and science, is going to be difficult to navigate. So it just comes down to self-awareness. You know, if you're really not enjoying clinical medicine, that's one thing. There's nothing that says that you can't do both at the same time. And there are models for doing that. There are many professors of medicine who are quadruple threats. You know, they teach, they train, they have startups on the side, and they do research in clinical medicine. So that's certainly possible. But to take the path that I took, that was a very personal decision around my personal circumstances. And it was the right decision in my case.
Terrific. Now, I want to ask you a little bit more about your first biotech startup, OncoSynergy. Could you tell me a little bit more about the startup, and how did you feel as a physician scientist trying to navigate that scene?
Yeah, so that's a great question. OncoSynergy was indeed my first startup. I suppose I had started thinking about, you know, potentially doing a startup even during my MD PhD years, because one of my classmates actually dropped out of the program and started a company after getting his PhD, much to the chagrin of the program director. I'm happy to report that he's doing very well, and he signed a $500 million deal with a major biotech company a couple years back. But, you know, that's 15 years in the making. It is a long slog. So OncoSynergy, so that's when I first thought about it. And, you know, when you think about being a physician scientist, your mandate is to advance medicine. And what I saw, not only from my mentors, but from the field in general, I didn't see a lot of that happening, really. What I saw was perpetual R01s for 2 decades, lots of high impact journals, lots of grants and money. But I didn't really see a lot of that translating into the clinic. Or even to consumers. And so that's why entrepreneurship was interesting for me, because, you know, this is our mandate as physician scientists, is having our training paid for by the government or by our tax dollars. I saw a huge opportunity to sort of, I guess, be a guinea pig along with my former classmate and sort of think about advancing medicine in an entrepreneurial way. Now, when you set up a lab in academia, it's sort of like a startup, right? So you have startup funds, and you basically have to fight to get investment through grants. The same thing in startups, only obviously the people that you get money from is different, and it's private money. So OncoSynergy started off basically as an idea after I made a discovery at Oxford. You know, I couldn't get the idea out of my head, and ultimately I couldn't get it even after I quit residency, I couldn't get any traction for it for 6 months. I was basically living in Beverly Hills and paying rent with no salary. And there was no options for me because there were no labs that you could rent like there are today. There were no J labs. There were no bio labs where I am now. And the only way you could do it is if you did it in the garage, but that's not safe, or you did it in academia. So ultimately, I decided to take my work into academia, and I found a position at UCSF as a postdoc, and I was able to actually get the initial work done through academia. Now, the good part about that is obviously I had the use of the facilities, which are high tech, and the resources were immense, and I got a salary. On the negative side, I basically had to give up ownership of my entire idea to UCSF, and then had to go back and license that from them, and which was not a straightforward task, and it almost prevented the company from launching. And just to give you more background on target CD29, it's an integrin. It's very fundamental for cancer biology and multiple mechanisms of progression and growth and drug resistance. It was thought to be an undruggable target. It was such an obvious target. Anyone who thought of the molecule, it plays a role in everything from angiogenesis to invasion, to proliferation, to drug resistance, to immune evasion, and even at the level of DNA repair. And so it's a really fundamental molecule. And so everyone thought it would be way too toxic to target. And I obviously thought different. And so we basically, over the course of 8 years, were able to get funding. I led the development of this idea from the bench top all the way to now the bedside. So last year, we got FDA clearance of our IND, which is the green light to start phase one trials. And the phase one trial is now open and actively enrolling patients at Moffitt Cancer Center in Florida.
That's really exciting. And it's really good to hear that there is, in some ways, a happy ending. Of course, the story is still going on. But I also want to focus a little bit more on the challenges, because the startup life is filled with potholes. Can you share some of the toughest challenges you faced along the way? And how did you get through them?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, startups are, it's all about uncertainty. You never, there's no prescribed path. You know, there's no real how-to book on how to do it. You just have to take the available data and make the best decisions at that time. So there are definitely difficulties. I already mentioned one. You know, I gave up the rights to my invention technically to UCSF, and then I had to beg them to license it back to me so that I could actually start the company. And it was an onerous process that took 27 months. And meanwhile, investors wouldn't fund me until I got that commitment from them. And so literally, I couldn't fund the company for 2 years, which almost killed it. So that's ironic. So a lot of it does revolve around money. I thought, you know, it'd be a little bit easier to raise money in biotech, but it's actually, I think, a little more difficult than straight up tech. And so, you know, we had many periods of feast or famine. We'd go months without any progress because we couldn't afford to move forward. And this happened perpetually, literally every year. even last year when we got the IND clearance, we were within a couple weeks of having to lay off everyone because again, we couldn't get some investors to bite. So, you know, even after making that, you know, we got FDA clearance. And this is a momentous occasion we were celebrating. And at the same time, in the back of my head, it was gut-wrenching because I literally was preparing to basically let go of the team that got me there, which was really difficult.
Wow, that's really moving. And I think that's something that, to just compare to what's going on right now, the COVID-19 vaccine effort has seen a near infinite amount of funding, near endless amount of volunteers to sign up for the clinical trials. And certainly that's moved the timeline so much so that it's been able to be developed all in 1 year. I would love to hear your reflections on what that would do for research more generally if there was this limitless amount of funding available for people like you. What would that do to research?
It's an interesting question. It depends who's in charge of the money, right? I mean, if it's truly limitless, then there really wouldn't be a problem. Well, sometimes I think not having endless money is a good way to drive innovation. And that was certainly true at our startup. It forced us to think about other ways of doing things. And so in that regard, it might be a bad thing, but it's hard to tell. And right, the money still, you know, Operation Warp Speed and all this government money, the RADx program, all this money still went to the big guys, right? None of it, as far as I can see, went to startups and people that are like at the ground level of innovation. Like all of it went to big pharma, all of it went to Harvard and other large institutions. It's a risk thing, right? In these times when you need to move fast, you're going to bet on a proven team, especially with a brand like Harvard or, you know, Pfizer, what have you. And so that's a different, you know, that's more like politics and stuff, which also happens, of course, in academia. But yeah, so I think it would be a good thing to have more money available. And that's actually one of the things that my nonprofit eventually would like to play a role in targeting that specifically to glioblastoma, of course.
Terrific. So let's focus on your nonprofit now. You've since left OncoSynergy to focus on your nonprofit Cure Glioblastoma, which you founded with WWE wrestler Barbie Blank. So what's the story behind the founding of Cure Glioblastoma, and what role do you see your nonprofit in literally curing glioblastoma?
Yes. So Cure Glioblastoma, it started with my disillusionment with the, I guess, you know, the funding situation with OncoSynergy. It was, you know, very frustrating. Because as we were talking about, you know, the government money, also investor money tends to go to, again, proven teams. You know, it's all about risk and stuff and such. And really these investors are trying to 10x their funds. And so they're most likely not going to choose a guy like me who's running a company, a startup for the first time and doesn't have, you know, a pedigree, of other people. And they'd much rather throw $50 million at a proven, you know, white-haired pharma team with an idea from a Nobel laureate. And so that became very frustrating as a startup. So let me just back up here. Yeah, so basically felt like the profit motive was unfortunately having too much of a say in the direction of therapeutic development. And for me, it's always been about the patients and putting patients first. And so, you know, as CEO of a biotech startup, a corporation, my job is literally to maximize returns for the investors, and the patients come secondary. And so that I had sort of a philosophical issue with that. And so basically the idea for Cure Glioblastoma sort of arose, you know, when one of the very deep, dark times at OncoSynergy in 2016, when, again, we were in a funding lull and I almost left the company. And I just started thinking about, hey, maybe there's a nonprofit way we can do this. So that's sort of where the seed happened. And then I was fortunate through social media, of course, to get in touch with certain celebrities and influencers. And I admit, Barbie Blank through Instagram. Her father passed away in 2018 from glioblastoma, February 27th. And then she started following me and I was like, what is going on here? And I, you know, checked Twitter and indeed her father had just passed away from glioblastoma. And so I reached out to her and said, hey, I've got this. And this was back in 2018. I've got this idea of maybe starting a nonprofit down the road, but I just wanted to keep you posted on that. And if you're interested, maybe you can help me out. She was enthusiastic about that. And then last year, 2019, after we got our FDA clearance, I made a decision to basically retire from the startup in order to make the nonprofit a reality. And so then I contacted Barbie again and said, hey, I'm going to move to California. Do you want to do this with me or not? And she was excited to get started. So that's basically what happened. And so our mandate is, you know, we're trying to actually make a big difference in as fast as we can. Not that the other foundations and nonprofits aren't, but we're trying to focus on areas we see as unmet needs in the area, particularly with my lens as a former, you know, CEO and founder of a biotech company. And so we have three mandates. Basically, we're trying to raise awareness, not only for the disease, but for ourselves, of course. We're trying to provide solutions and resources for patients today, and we're investing in the future. So the awareness part is pretty obvious. We're trying to put out these social media campaigns using our celebrity friends, which has been great. And that's been very successful and has led to a lot of growth in our nonprofit over the past year. The second thing is, you know, we're trying to find ways to help patients today. You know, we can't make a drug overnight. And so what are the things we can do? And so we're trying to provide resources, you know, curate resources. And that's still sort of in the works. And that's what my team and I are working on currently. We just launched a blog on the website. And so that's part of that mandate. And what we're focusing on, the majority of my time currently has been focusing on the third vision, which is investing in the future. And this has multiple parts. Basically, we're doing our own research. So we've now have our own lab in Torrance, California, on the campus of UCLA Harbor Hospital and in the LA Biolabs building. So we have our own research underway internally. And I basically want to build this. I had this vision 20 years ago, but one of the things I want to do is build basically the Bell Labs of biotech. And so we're going to, I've got lots of ideas. And so we're building IP portfolio, which we can potentially down the road become a revenue stream for the nonprofit. So we don't have to rely on individual donors. The other thing I want to do is bring in entrepreneurs and accelerate research. So we're calling it the Cure Motive Research Accelerator. And so it's basically to address, you know, what I went through 10 years ago with OncoSynergy. There were no places to get data where a university wouldn't own it. And so I want to make a place where, you know, an entrepreneur or scientist can come in with an crazy idea, test it out, get some preliminary data with which they can try to obtain some grants or some angel funding. And so that's the other part. And then the final part of that is we also want to get into, once our coffers are a little bit fuller, we want to get into angel and venture philanthropy and actually invest in companies that are addressing glioblastoma. And again, that equity would come back into the nonprofit. And that's another way we can raise a lot of money. And several nonprofits are starting to do this, which I think is great. I guess actually there's one more, I lied. One more thing is we're investing in the future of people in the field. And so we're trying to put together some fellowships for trainees and students. And in particular, of course, given the events in the summer, we are also discussing a particular fellowship for research for underrepresented minorities.
Certainly. I think that, I mean, rare diseases in general often struggle to gain traction with the lay public, but I think your multi-tiered approach of cured glioblastoma is going to go a long way. Now, many students aspire to make an impact, to change the world around them for the better. Given your perspectives as the CEO of a biotech startup and now the president of a 501c3 charity organization, what do you think is the best avenue to make meaningful, lasting change?
That's a great question. It depends on the person, right? And again, how-to doesn't really work because it also has to come into the context of what makes the individual happy. And so that's a self-awareness question. You know, for me, in my position, having made that discovery at Oxford, entrepreneurship was the right choice. I think I don't regret leaving clinical medicine, although I do miss the procedures. I do miss interacting with patients. But I was able to do what I set out to do, which is invent a new drug for brain cancer and bring it to patients, at least, you know, in the first sense as a phase 1 clinical trial. And so it depends. Again, so you can still stay in clinical medicine and do things on the side, just like yourself, becoming more interested in policy, doing research, doing clinical research. There's a lot of ways to scale your impact. And again, it's a really personal thing based on what makes you happy and where you find your zone of genius, I suppose. And so that concept of zone of genius is something from Justin Kahn from Y Combinator. But basically, you know, try to focus 80% of your time on your zone of genius and only 20% on stuff you don't like as much. And for me, that's always been sort of being in the lab, nitty-gritty preclinical discovery stuff. And so that's also contributed to why I eventually decided to leave OncoSynergy because I was no longer doing that. You know, we had the drug that we need to get to patients. And so I was no longer in my zone of genius. And so that's part of how Cure Glioblastoma came about. And I see that as an opportunity to get back in my zone of genius.
This idea of zone of genius is fascinating. To ask a more general question now, where do you see glioblastoma and cancer treatment more generally going in the next 10 to 15 years? What are you most excited about?
Another fantastic question. So I think the current wave, in my personal bias, lies in immunotherapies. You know, our immune system is so powerful, and I do believe that eventually we can help it do its job, right? And so when you're talking in big pharma and even in the hospital and you have cancer, it's really binary. You're either getting a checkpoint inhibitor or you're not. And so the world right now in clinical oncology is, are you getting a PD-1 inhibitor, CTLA-4 inhibitor, or PD-L1 inhibitor? Because they've, you know, obviously they won the Nobel Prize, James Allis, but, you know, it's literally cured patients. And so, and it's just a taste, of course, only about 20-25% of patients do respond in certain types of cancer. But I do believe that we can find the combinations of these types of technologies to address most cancers, including glioblastoma. The other thing I'm really interested in is diagnostics and biomarkers, because a lot of these cancers that are, you know, arguably the worst of the worst, like pancreatic and glioblastoma, are because it grows so insidiously and quietly. And by the time you diagnose it, it's stage four and there's not much you can do. And so there's a lot of cool technology out there from, you know, looking at methylation status. There's some really cool work just from blood samples. You can look at the methylome of glioblastoma cells and you can identify them by subtype. And so that technology is brand new, of course, and it hasn't been cleared for wider use yet, but that's really exciting stuff. And so not only can we potentially diagnose sooner and cheaper just by drawing, you know, 10 milliliters of blood, but we can also monitor patients and how they respond to treatment. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And I think that nearly wraps up the episode. But before we go, could I ask you for your three pieces of advice for students interested in making an impact in healthcare?
Great. So I think I mentioned all three of these already, but just to distill it down, number one, I'd say, you know, keep patients first. That sort of speaks for itself. Number two, keep happiness as your North Star. This, again, requires some self-awareness, but I just heard this from Brené Brown, but she says, you can only love others as much as you love yourself. And it's, I think the same applies to, you know, helping other people. And so be self-aware and make sure that you keep happiness as your North Star and not, for instance, money and financial returns, I've made a lot of money eventually through OncoSynergy, but it didn't really make me happy. It was the earlier work, the innovation that really made me happy. The last thing I would say is basically changing your mind is a strength. And again, this is a self-awareness thing. You know, don't have your entire identity wrapped up in your career, because my identity, I don't know how I knew this, but early on, my identity had always been someone who was going to advance medicine. And so that was me. That was my identity in the macro. In the micro, of course, during pre-med and in med school, my micro identity was becoming an academic neurosurgeon that focused on glioblastoma. You know, and eventually I decided not to do that, but I didn't have a crisis of identity because I knew I was still going to be someone who advanced medicine. And I was able to do that at OncoSynergy by inventing a new drug for brain cancer. And I now believe I'm going to do that in the nonprofit sector through Cure Glioblastoma.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you so much, Dr. Carbonell, for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Summer.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.